This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Almost exactly 101 years ago, as the United States was about to enter World War I, a man named Bill Kennedy crossed the finish line of the Boston Marathon with his gray hair covered by a bandana displaying the stars and stripes. All the men running that race were amateurs. They ran for the love of the sport, and in that respect, they were similar to most of the 30,000 runners who will cross the finish line in Boston on Monday. Only a Game's Karen Given has our story.
Growing up, Patrick Kennedy was often asked if he was related to those Kennedys. You know, JFK, RFK, Ted. He's not.
Correct. Not related to the more famous Kennedys. Or like I said, well, they're not related to us, you know.
But there is one famous Kennedy in Patrick's family line. He was known as Bricklayer Bill. Patrick didn't know much about his most famous relative until one night in 2010, when Patrick was out to dinner with his family. A distant cousin named Anne Louise was there. She was in her 80s, and she had grown up knowing Bill.
Anne Louise, out of the blue, said, well, you know, he gave me a manuscript. And we all dropped our forks and just were dumbfounded.
That's Patrick's father, Lawrence Kennedy. It took Anne Louise a little while, but eventually she found the manuscript in her basement. Or most of it. She'd set one chapter aside for safekeeping. Then she lost it. It wasn't found until after her death. Anyway.
I got it from Anne Louise. You know, came home. I remember my wife was making pasta, and I sat there in the kitchen reading every page, you know, in one sitting.
The manuscript was 75 or 80 pages, full of mistakes and typos, with notes and corrections in the margins. Patrick says his great-granduncle was a talented writer, even though he probably never finished high school.
He read widely. He quoted poems. He quoted Kipling and Shakespeare.
And this is how Patrick Kennedy first read the words of Bill Kennedy, born in 1883.
What in the name of God ever started you men running 26 miles?
The words of Bill Kennedy are being read by actor Mike Lovell. Bill's manuscript was full of little stories, like the one about his encounter with a stylishly dressed woman named Mrs. Levy, who approached Bill and a group of fellow marathoners in the lobby of New York's Long Beach Hotel.
You may wonder, as did Mrs. Levy, why men run so far for a medal or trophy. Other questions so often asked are, what do you think of along the road? Are you not afraid you'll drop dead running so far? And the commercial one so often asked, don't you get paid for running?
Bill Kennedy's running obsession began in 1896, months after the first Olympic marathon was held in Athens, Greece. The first U.S. marathon ran through Bill's hometown of Port Chester, New York.
When the leaders were running through, he and his friends all just jumped in and ran alongside them and saw them off at the railroad bridge out of town.
Bill became a bricklayer, like his father. He moved west and settled in St. Louis, which is where he witnessed the 1904 Summer Olympics and finally decided to give marathoning a try.
And that kind of became his passion.
In the early days of the sport, races were sponsored by posh athletic clubs, and they were strictly amateur. But most of the men who ran the long-distance races weren't posh at all.
Plumbers, carpenters, you know, other bricklayers, you know, the bulk of them were kind of working-class guys.
The athletic clubs would sponsor runners, paying their travel expenses. But you had to establish yourself as a contender first. A train ticket could cost a week's wages. So Lawrence says...
He would hobo, just take freight cars or ride on the top of a baggage car, any way that he could. He really didn't have the money, and he really didn't like to pay the money.
The weather was mild in St. Louis, so I crossed the bridge to East St. Louis and climbed into a boxcar. After sundown, the wind shifted north, and it was down to zero by the time we reached Decatur, Illinois. The next evening, with the thermometer at 10 below... I rode a boxcar to Chicago, jogging back and forth to keep from freezing. At every stop, the end brakeman walked up to my Pullman, banging on the door. He would shout, "Are you awake, Bricky?" "Yes, sir." "Don't go to sleep or you'll never wake up."
Sitting at his kitchen table that evening, reading that manuscript for the first time, Patrick came across one story so unexpected that he pushed aside Bill's tattered pages and pulled out his computer.
I went right to the Library of Congress website, and I found, sure enough, front page.
The year was 1909. Bill was in Des Moines, Iowa, working on the Des Moines Coliseum. It was towards the end of the project, and Bill was leaning out over the sidewalk, scraping excess mortar from the south wall.
A gust of wind blew him off the roof. He fell 5 stories. It was a 65-foot fall. There was a pedestrian walking right underneath him. Bill landed on him. And killed the poor guy. And at first they thought Bill died too, and then they went over and saw that he was still breathing. He went to the hospital. He survived.
Bill didn't have much to say about the incident.
Like, he didn't go into how he felt or anything like that. The way he put it was, my number wasn't up that day. In the next paragraph, he says, you know, after I recovered, I realized I was fit enough to keep running. That was pretty much, his first concern,
This would be a theme in Bill Kennedy's life. No matter how far he fell, literally or figuratively, he would get up. And when he did, his first thought would turn to running. It happened again in 1913. Here's Patrick.
He had had such a great year. I think it was something like in the space of 10 weeks, he had won 2 marathons and several shorter races. And then that fall, he was stricken with typhoid fever.
This was before the days of penicillin. Typhoid fever could be deadly. Bill was in the hospital for more than 3 months. He survived.
But the way the one of the Chicago papers put it was that he was hollowed out. He was a shell of his former self.
Patrick says Bill appeared to age decades in just a few months. His face became wrinkled. His hair turned gray.
Actually, my dad went gray pretty early, but I think in Bill's case it was triggered by the typhoid.
Nobody expected Bill to return to the marathon circuit.
Yeah, most of the doctors at the hospital had told him, yeah, your running days are over. But then he told this one doctor, he said,
as soon as I was able, I would have to go back to laying brick, which was hard manual labor for 8 hours, while the marathon took less than 3 hours. On the job, you had a boss breathing down the back of your neck. In racing, you had a cheery word and the applause of the crowd. So Doc says, you got something there. Go to it, and good luck.
Bill recovered well enough to run the Boston Marathon in 1915, but his running club had cut him loose, thinking his best days were over. He rode the rails and arrived with nothing more than his running clothes wrapped in a newspaper. After a bath, he walked down to Newspaper Row, where Boston's 9 daily papers were located.
Larry was astonished when I told him how I got to Boston. He called Mr. Barnes, his boss, to whom I had to repeat my story.
That is actually how Bill gained his fame.
By the time Bill Kennedy lined up at the start of the Boston Marathon in 1917, wearing that Stars and Stripes bandana, he was 33 years old. Lawrence says the papers rounded up to 35.
Nobody had ever won the Boston Marathon over the age of 30. So he clearly wasn't considered to be one of the favorites.
The guys who were favored to win were a couple of finish runners. The only question was, which one of them is going to win.
Marathons are difficult to predict, and Bill Kennedy was much younger and fitter than he looked. Bill took the lead after less than 10 miles.
There was, some risk that he had run too hard too soon. And sure enough, here he is in Brookline on a downward slope. That's when he started to fade. He almost got dizzy and weak and felt like his legs were lead.
Marathoners call it hitting the wall, and Bill hit it hard. His marathon might have been lost if not for a newspaper reporter in a chase car who noticed the leader was slowing down and shouted at him to speed up. Bill crossed the finish line first in 2 hours, 28 minutes, and 37 seconds. He told reporters,
"It's great to win the marathon, but it doesn't buy any steaks or potatoes or onions these days. And there's Mrs. Kennedy and the 2 little Kennedys out there in Chicago."
The next morning, Bill returned to work at the bricklaying job he'd taken in Boston to pay his expenses while he was in town.
But then it started raining. They called off work for the day, and then he went to Newspaper Row and talked to this guy, Spargo, this sports columnist.
Bill had a habit of seeking out reporters when he had something to say, and on this afternoon, he was apparently feeling philosophical. He compared marathoning with a daily grind of men like him, men who struggled to feed their families on $12 or $14 a week.
Many a times, that man realizes he's on the toughest marathon in this life, but the right fellow never quits. He goes on trying his best when his better judgment tells him he's up against it. I know, believe me. for I've been over those jumps myself.
Bill Kennedy ran more than 100 marathons, retiring from the sport at 57. He continued to lay brick well into his 70s. A few years before his death at the age of 84, Bill decided to sit down at that manual typewriter and share what he'd learned over decades of running. He wrote 26 chapters, one for each mile of the marathon. Some of his stories still contain good lessons, like this one.
Feeling rather chesty after doing 5 miles under 26 minutes, I turned to Mr. Wilson, our coach. How am I doing, coach? Am I laying them down all right? Never mind how you lay them down. Keep picking them up, was his reply. Later on that evening, thinking of his remark, it dawned on me. Why, sure, that's the secret of running. Keep picking them up. And I smiled at the thought. They go down on their own.
Bill Kennedy's manuscript was never published, but if it had been, it would have been called Keep Picking 'Em Up. Lawrence Kennedy finds the title fitting.
I think that's what he did in his life. He just kept going and kept going forward.
Patrick and Lawrence Kennedy excerpted Bill Kennedy's manuscript for their book, Bricklayer Bill, The Untold Story of the Working Man's Boston Marathon, and we'll have a link at onlyagame.org. Our story was reported and produced by Only a Game's Karen Given. Most of today's marathoners won't have to come back from a bout with typhoid fever, but almost all of them have faced injuries and setbacks on their way to the finish line. Commentator Alyssa Eli can relate.
An athletic injury is a little like a pregnancy. Everyone wants to tell you their labor story. They pat your stomach and can't wait to give you details. A 30-hour delivery is nothing next to a 46-hour one without anesthesia. The competition is ferocious. It just so happened that my athletic injury had not occurred during a raging Himalayan ice storm when I was yards from the summit, alone except for companionable death, and so close to the top that sky could be tasted. My injury was from power walking to the dentist. Still, pregnancy is pregnancy, and an Achilles tendonitis is a visual cue. The limp immediately reminded anyone who noticed of something worse that had happened to them, something much, much worse, which they were compelled to share. My tendon gave strangers a great deal of storytelling satisfaction. There was the woman in her 20s, a non-hiker, inspired by the best-selling author Cheryl Strayed. Off to the Appalachian Trail with her, and then, somewhere near Clingman's Dome in Tennessee, mad with blisters, she called her mother to pick her up and bring plenty of foot cream. A 70-year-old told me about when he went up for a rebound in a pickup basketball game, came down, and to his astonishment, couldn't rise. A newlywed couple both developed plantar fasciitis in the Grand Canyon, their first shared experience as husband and wife. Every story was different in detail, but similar in theme. The body never expects it will fail. First there's disbelief, then an inkling of mortality. It's the fall after the pride. To be honest, sometimes the tale seemed a little stretched. I myself have been imprecise on this topic from time to time. For instance, the big toe I broke in Zion National Park. It wasn't actually from hiking the West Rim Trail, though I did. It was from the very large suitcase that toppled off a baggage carousel at the airport after the trip was over. But since I've polished a few details, and since the nail has grown back, I have to say, it's made a terrific labor story.
Alyssa Eli is a community psychiatrist in Massachusetts. While riding the train to a recent away match to support his favorite soccer team, James Beardwell made a video recording his plans.
I'm going to keep up the support going throughout the 90 minutes, and it needs to be a lot better because the Witham Town players would really appreciate my Witham Town support.
Sounds easy, right? Think again. That story's coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
Hey, it's Maria Hinojosa, host of NPR's Latino USA, the podcast that takes you inside the Latino conversation. Each week, we'll take you into one story that will fascinate and often surprise you. Listen to Latino USA on the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Bill Littlefield, and it's time for Three Stories You Should Know. This week, Hall of Fame linebacker Ray Lewis offered his take on the controversy surrounding New York Giants wide receiver Odell Beckham Jr. "Where there's no God," he said, "there's chaos." Lewis also said that Beckham, quote, "has removed God from his life." And that's where we're going to start this week. I'm joined by Julie DeCaro, update anchor and host at Chicago's 670 The Score, and by A. Martinez, host of KPCC's Take Two. Welcome to both of you.
Hello.
Hi, guys.
Julie, I understand you have some thoughts about Ray Lewis's remarks.
I do. I am here today to humbly beg the sports world to stop soliciting opinions from Hall of Fame linebacker Ray Lewis. Earlier this week, Lewis, who had been sort of an amateur preacher since retiring from the game after the 2012 season, offered up his opinion on Giants wide receiver Odell Beckham Jr. OBJ was in a video that went viral a few weeks back. He was seen in bed with a woman, a large pizza, and I mean, who among us? And what could have been possibly marijuana or cocaine, but it was really hard to tell. And that, coupled with OBJ's demands for a new contract, prompted Lewis to weigh in with the assessment that where there's no God, there is chaos. Ray Lewis then goes on to ramble about OBJ hanging out with Justin Timberlake and then revealed what is probably the true motivation behind his rant, that Odell Beckham Jr. stopped taking Ray Lewis's calls. Look, I'm tired of the constant innuendo about OBJ's private life, but it's especially galling coming from Ray Lewis, who, as we all recall, was charged with the double homicide back in the early 2000s following a post-Super Bowl party fight. Now, granted, Lewis has a history of terrible takes on social issues, but they all boil down to his sanctimonious lectures about what God wants and who's godly enough, which begs the question, why does anyone ever ask Ray Lewis's opinion on anything? If he's going to be foist upon us, let's have him stick to X's and O's and leave his opinions on people's private lives out of it.
Are you going to join Julie in assuming that Mr. Lewis should not be consulted on matters beyond X's and O's?
Well, the thing is, Ray Lewis has always worn his faith on his sleeve. It's kind of it's what you know him for. So I don't understand why anyone is surprised that he would inject God, religion, faith in what he does. At its core, discussing Odell Beckham Jr. is an X's and O's conversation. But for Ray Lewis, clearly, it also means that he has to add God into the mix. Like God's trying to cover OBJ in some way. I don't think God could cover Odell Beckham Jr. one-on-one. But that's part of what he does. It's his shtick. And if people get upset if I call religion a shtick, that's exactly what it is for Ray Lewis. And if you see it in those lenses or with those lenses, then I think people won't be as upset as some have.
I remember reading at some point that Albert Einstein said, "I want to know the thoughts of God. The rest are mere details." He said, "I want to know the thoughts of God," not "I know the thoughts of God, and I'm ready to tell you what they are and what the consequences are if you don't pay attention to the way I think you should have God in your life." I'm very uncomfortable with people who feel that it's their responsibility to tell other people how they should live their lives. And I'm going to leave it at that, Julie, and let you wrap it up, because I think we've probably made enough people uncomfortable and angry already.
Yeah, well, I mean, I agree with A, that it is his shtick, and it's a thing that he pulls out every time he seems to not know what to say. But, I mean, given the fact that, you know, the white suit that Ray Lewis was wearing when these guys were murdered was never found, he admitted to lying to the police. Just dial it down a little bit and maybe don't go off on the moral relativism of other people's life choices.
A, let's move on to your topic, since I think we've covered this one pretty thoroughly.
All right, so Darius Bakley, he is a 6'9" wing player. It's kind of a guard slash forward. And he is one of the best high school basketball players in the country. He had committed to the University of Syracuse. He just decided to decommit to Syracuse. He will not be going to college. He will instead sign in the NBA's G League. Now, that's causing a bit of a stir because this is the first high-profile player that has decided to sign with the NBA's minor league. And it's got people wondering exactly what this means for college basketball, what this means for the NBA's developmental league as well. And it makes you wonder, Bill and Julie, if at some point, are colleges just going to be filled with people who want to be in college? The horror, right? The horror that that could actually be the case, that people actually want to be there because they want to be college students. So the NCAA now has a bit of a problem how to make themselves more attractive so that kids like Darius decide to go to college. And the NBA is now realizing that, heck, you know what? We've got to figure out a way to structure this where we don't seem like we're siphoning off the best high school players away from colleges like Syracuse and Duke. So it's been kind of an uncomfortable relationship, but with Darius Blakely deciding to defect, now all of a sudden it's right there in front of everyone's faces.
Julie, are you similarly concerned that one day people will go to college in order to go to college rather than to play basketball?
Look, I went to Indiana. I'm a huge college basketball fan, but something's got to give, right? I mean, something has got to change. This huge scandal's unfolding. We've got these guys are working like pro athletes, yet they're not being paid at all, and the school's making millions off them. I had sort of hoped that the HBCU college track thing would sort of take off, where a lot of the top athletes would go to historically black colleges and universities. They would tell the NCAA where to get off, and then guys could be paid. They could do endorsement deals. But I think the G League is a great alternative. And I'm not a person who minds seeing college talent at a lesser level than the NBA. I know that bothers a lot of people. They say that, you know, college basketball is just not as good as the NBA. Of course it's not. They're college players. And so if we have guys going to wind up with guys, you know, in college who actually want to be there to study and are true student athletes, I'm all for that.
When I first became aware of this story, I assumed that Darius Baisley couldn't find a university with a sufficiently wealthy booster organization, which certainly would have paid him much more than the G League would. But maybe it would be the very best thing that could happen to college basketball and maybe even college football if they were rendered less significant on the landscape by arrangements like this.
And here's the thing, too. You have an option where no one cares that a bunch of high school baseball players decide to sign professional contracts when they turn 18 and wind up going to the minor leagues. So now, if this winds up to be the way it goes for high-level high school basketball players, then at least you know exactly what they're there to do. They're 18, they're adults, they can make money off of their skills, and if they want to go to college, then you know they're there because they want to be there. So I think it's a win-win if this winds up to be the way it goes going forward.
I want to turn the clock back at least to start. 20 summers ago, Mark McGwire hit 70 home runs, and his season-long home run hitting contest with Sammy Sosa was very exciting, and everybody was cheering both of them, or at least one of the two. And then it became apparent that McGwire's production had been, in part at least, fueled by performance-enhancing drugs. This week, we learned that McGwire had told Jason Stark of The Athletic that absolutely I could have hit all those home runs without any steroids at all. I don't have any idea whether he could have hit all those home runs without any steroids at all. I am intrigued that he's now saying that he could have. And I wonder, is he making a case for eventually getting into the Hall of Fame? He's 54 years old now. Is he trying to recreate himself for posterity? He had a very solid big league career. His numbers are his numbers. How many people does he think care what he took 20 years ago to hit 70 home runs, eh?
Well, clearly he thinks that people do care, and clearly he cares what people think about him. Now, he is correct in that, look, he's always had power. I remember he was a first baseman at USC hitting home runs. He had 49 home runs as a rookie with the Oakland A's before there was a whiff of him taking anything like steroids. Mm-hmm. If he decides for a baseball season in his prime and say, I'm going to swing for the fences 500 times, I think someone with his power probably could hit 70 home runs, maybe could hit 80 home runs. But that's not how sports works. He has to play within the team concept. He has to try and win games. Once in a while, he has to swing for a single as opposed to a home run. So if that's all he's there to do for an entire season, sure, 70, 80, 90, whatever. But in the realistic team sports kind of concept, that won't happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think he cares what people think because he's not going into the Hall of Fame, at least not, you know, unless he gets inducted by the Old Timers Committee at some point. But he got 12.3% of the vote in 2017. His 10 years are up. And, you know, one thing we know about these guys is they do care about how they're remembered by history. You know, I don't doubt that he has the power to hit 70 home runs, but how long would he have lasted realistically had he not been taking things to help him recover, to help him heal, to help him stay in the game? I mean, I think that Barry Bonds gets a pass to some extent because we all feel he would have been a Hall of Famer without having taken any PEDs. But Mark McGwire doesn't necessarily get that benefit of the doubt. So, I mean, he can talk all he wants, but the fact is he didn't do it.
Well, it's going to be another topic for another day whether Barry Bonds gets a pass, and I can't wait to climb onto that one. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Julie DeCaro, update anchor and host at Chicago's 670 The Score, and A. Martinez, host of KPCC's Take Two. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Thanks, Bill.
Our next story has elements of marathoning in it, sort of. I mean, it's a stretch, sure, but bear with me. Here's the marathoner of sorts.
My name is James Beardwell, and I live in Whittam in Essex.
Maybe you know of Whittam in Essex. It's hard by Hatfield Peveril, a short ride from Tiptree Heath, just a bit south of White Notley. And like lots and lots of cities and towns in the UK, Whittam in Essex has a soccer team, Whittam Town. James Beardwell has autism, and he loves Whittam Town enough to follow the lads anywhere.
I travel on the public transport, on the trains for long journeys and buses for shorter journeys, like shorter journeys like to Heybridge and Maldon Tiptree and stuff.
Perhaps you cheer on Manchester United or Chelsea or Liverpool. Those clubs play in the Premiership, which is a league six or seven levels above the Bostic League North Division, wherein Whittam Town nestles, inspiring the loyalty of James Beardwell.
And every time at the Whittam Town home and away matches, I sang loud as possible to sound like 100 to 1,000 fans, like the raise to raise the top of my voice as loud as I can.
On a particular weekend in February, James, bright in his yellow team jersey and blue team scarf, did what he's accustomed to doing during the soccer season.
I'm currently on the train on my way to Grays Athletic for the Whittam Town away match to Grays Athletic in Aveley.
James makes videos of himself on these journeys. He posts them online.
I'm going to keep up the support going throughout the 90 minutes, and it needs to be a lot better, because the Whittam Town players would really appreciate my Whittam Town support.
Such support, and you'll learn soon enough how energetic it is, would likely inspire other fans, right? Sure, and perhaps it would have done so at that game against Grays Athletic. But when James reached the pitch, he discovered that he was the only Whittam Town supporter to have made the trip to Grays. Ah well, he must have thought, sing loud, carry on.
And I sang so loud as possible. And I remember that song I was singing behind the goal away at Grays Athletic was The Beardwell's on Fire.
Can you sing a bit of it for us?
It goes, Beardwell's on fire. Your support is very dire. Beardwell's on fire. Ooh. Na 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 na. Na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na.
Someone on the opposite sideline caught James on video. Did anybody ever say to you during that extraordinary performance, James, shut up, that's enough?
No. Because like some people say, like, what an amazing supporter I am, and they said, like, they couldn't believe how loud I was, because they think I'm really loud to sound like 100 to 1,000 fans.
Hard as it may be to believe, given the level of support, 90 non-stop minutes of song and shouting from their number one and that day only fan, Whittam Town lost the match. When it was over, some of the players sought out James.
Sorry about the result, buddy.
No, sir, I kept the low support.
What up, mate?
Low support. Unlucky, mate.
Sorry.
That's all right.
The connection evident in those exchanges, it's real. James recently told the Whittam Town players that he was planning to marry. He said the whole team would get invitations. The video of James Beardwell singing was posted online after that match against Grays Athletic. It was widely appreciated. James knew that because when Whittam Town next took to the pitch, he had company.
We had about 407 attendance. It was the highest ever attendance we had in Whitton Town's history, and I'm really pleased we got more attendance.
Pretty obviously, James was responsible for the team's sudden popularity. Certainly, it wasn't Whitton Town's record. They've been hopeless, or useless, as they say in the UK, 14th in their division, which dismayed James Beardwell not a whit.
I would never stop supporting the team, Whitton Town, because I'll always be there through thick and thin, watching Whitton Town home and away.
It doesn't seem to matter to you that the team loses. The game is great anyway.
Yeah, the game is great because, like, I really enjoy, like, just keep supporting the team, like, because not many people do that.
Right. Not many people do that. And can there be any doubt that James Beardwell will do it at the next away match, even when the rest of those Whitton Town fans have found somewhere else to be? You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
Are you funnier than Fallon? More amusing than Aziz? More clever than Click and Clack? Well, if you've got an idea that'll make people laugh, enter WBUR's Next Great Show contest for a chance to get your show on the air. To find out more, go to WBUR.org/nextgreatshow.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, the worst sports sponsorship ever, without question. But right now it's time for my discussion of the week's news with Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Shohei Ohtani, simultaneously one of the best pitchers in the major leagues and also one of the best hitters, has been playing a lot for the Angels so far this season, and he told his manager he wants to play more often. And if you're an Angels fan, you're really good with that, right?
I'm not entirely sure, though. You know, he falls down running out of the batter's box and hurts his pitching arm, or he overpitches and he can't swing the bat anymore. This is a very unique set of problems, but right from the moment, he's the best thing that's happened to baseball in a very long time.
Yes, and it's safe to say that those accidents could happen no matter what. I say, play him. Play him.
Well, you can't
and
pitch,
then play him
you
some
can't
more.
Pitch him every day.
No,
but
no,
you can
I
DH
know.
Him between starts. There's
absolutely,
nothing wrong with that.
Absolutely. In the very early going, the baseball season has brought us several bench-clearing brawls. I wonder if this is because the players who would normally be sitting in the dugout or the bullpen are just looking for a way to stay warm.
Well, there's nothing funnier, of course, in a baseball brawl. The long, slow, disinterested trot of the bullpen crew towards the fight, which they know will be over by the time they get there.
I hope.
We saw a perfect example of that with the Red Sox and Yankees the other night, where there was a serious brawl. And then here come the bullpen guys. And, of course, they run right next to each other. They don't, like, stop and fight the other bullpen in the outfield. They both trot in together and then, like, push and grab people.
The NBA playoffs get underway this weekend. 8 matchups. Count them 8. Which ones do you like?
I like Portland and New Orleans because I think New Orleans is peaking at the right time. And New Orleans has one of the players who can turn an entire series around by himself in Anthony Davis. So if I had access to the Only Game corporate jet and I could go to an entire series, I would go to Portland and New Orleans.
The only good thing about being an NBA team so bad that you don't make the playoffs is that you get to create a good story or two at the end of the season. The L.A. Lakers did that on Tuesday night with a not-so-young man named Andre Ingram after 10 years in the minors. I guess it's fair to say Mr. Ingram made the most of his NBA debut.
Yeah, he walked into the big time, scored 19 against the Rockets.
Beautiful.
What a great story. You know, and apparently Chris Paul, the Houston point guard, went up to him before the game and told him how much he respected Ingram for hanging in there. Ingram's 32 years old.
Right.
And he finally got his shot.
The NHL playoffs are underway, and wise guys at Sportsline have given the Vegas Knights an 18% chance of winning the Stanley Cup. They're an expansion team. I don't know if this is realistic, but does that number result from a home field advantage? I mean, the odds are made in Las Vegas,
I was going to say, is that a home field advantage among bookmakers?
Yeah.
No, they're a good team. Not only a good team, they're a great story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they are the most successful North American expansion team probably ever. They won their first playoff game, which, of course, was attended by all kinds of Las Vegas foo-for-ah. I would like to see a Western Conference final between them and the Nashville Predators. I think Nashville versus Las Vegas would be the new NHL at its finest.
Pittsburgh Penguin Center Sidney Crosby sent a personal message to each of the people who survived the bus crash that killed many of those on or associated with the Humboldt Broncos hockey team. A lot of other NHL players have also paid tribute to that team. We have often, you and I, talked about the hockey community. Here it is again.
There's no question. This is from the lowliest squirt and mite all the way up to Sidney Crosby. If you're within the hockey community, you're in family. There's a lovely tribute being paid all over Canada now where you leave a hockey stick outside your door in case one of the boys wants to come home and play, which I just think is enormously touching.
That's terrific. The South Korean Basketball League has come under scrutiny for discriminating against certain players. What's the controversy there, and who are the victims?
The victims are the tall people, Bill. It's just not fair, apparently. Teams can only have two foreign players, and one cannot be taller than 6 foot six, and the other must be below 6 foot one. This is a new rule that's going to take place next year. Apparently, the big Americans were coming over and spoiling things for everyone.
Yeah, but I note that you and I could play because I'm not over 6'6".
Yeah, but I still stink, so I can't play.
We all love Major League Day games, especially school kids who like to play hooky now and again. One Chicago fourth grader recently did that, and he got a big surprise at the Cubs' home opener.
Oh, my goodness, Tucker Steckman. The fates were not smiling on you, big guy. He shows up for the day game, and he runs into who? His principal, who's also going to the game. The principal and Tucker are now Wrigley Field lore. If the Cubs somehow don't win this year, it's going to be either Tucker's fault or the principal's fault, probably the principal.
And finally, Charlie, win or lose, the Green Bay Packers have never lacked for enthusiastic fans, and thanks to quarterback Aaron Rodgers, they picked up still another recently in India. You might recognize him.
Yeah, I don't know why Aaron Rodgers was in Dharamsala at the time, but there's a picture of... I can't look at this picture without laughing. There's a picture of the Dalai Lama wearing a Packers hat and holding a football.
And he's laughing, too.
And I'll tell you what, it's good to be the Dalai Lama at this point, because you can do practically anything if you're the Dalai Lama, and people will love you for it.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time, and of course he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Dennis Rainier was 10 miles into the Grand Valley Marathon when he was hit. Something struck the top of his head and nearly knocked him over. He staggered for a few steps, then...
put my hand immediately to my head, and it was just like in the cartoons where you see a guy get a big goose egg on his head when he gets bonked. Well, sure enough, I had a big goose egg on my head.
Only a Game Shira Springer takes the story from there.
Dennis's head started throbbing, his ears ringing, and his vision blurring. But he looked at his hand and didn't see any blood. So he kept running and thinking,
what's wrong here? Am I like running in mud? Why can't I move? This is not going the way my training has been going.
It was 1978, right in the middle of the running boom, and it was Dennis's fourth marathon. He was in the best shape of his life, and he was confident he would run a personal best at Grand Valley, even though it was unseasonably warm for November in Michigan. But after he was hit, that confidence quickly disappeared.
I was losing about 15, 20 seconds a mile, and I was getting frustrated. Further on I got, the more wobbly I got. I had a little trouble focusing my eyes. And again, I was trying to rationalize what in the world happened here.
Was some kid throwing rocks at runners around mile 10? Could he have been hit by a branch he didn't see? A brick? Finally, Dennis convinced himself it had to be dehydration. He downed Gatorade and defizzed Coca-Cola and dumped water on his head. Nothing helped. He pushed through the pain and the wobbliness as best he could. More than anything, Dennis wanted to finish in 3 hours or better. That would qualify him for the Boston Marathon.
I don't think I'm unique in that drive. And anyone who mentioned the word marathon, the next word would be Boston. Did you go? Have you gone? Can you go? I really had no goals beyond that at that point, just wanted to go to Boston and earn it.
That's why he decided to run the Grand Valley Marathon in the first place. It was a couple hours away from his home in Midland, Michigan, where he lived with his wife, Linda, and worked as a chemist for the Dow Corning Corporation. Grand Valley was a small race, about 300 runners, and the course covered mostly flat, rural roads. At the time, Dennis was 26, and his wife, Linda, was 4 months pregnant with the couple's first child. Linda was waiting for Dennis at the finish just outside Grand Rapids, and she would be waiting for much longer than she expected. Dennis slowed to a walk around the 20-mile mark.
It was only to see if it would clear my head and give me some better focus, but never did the thought occur to me, well, I better sit or quit or take a ride or bail. It never even occurred to me, actually.
And why was that? Why didn't that occur to you?
Well, it's either stupidity or dedication. You can take your pick. Probably stupidity more than anything.
If he'd known then why he was slowing down, Dennis would have dropped out of the race. But all he knew was that walking only made the pain and the dizziness worse. So he started running again. He summoned enough energy to finish strong. He crossed the line with both hands in the air. His time was 3 hours and 9 minutes. Not good enough for Boston. His wife walked over to him.
As she approached me, she had her hands up and was clapping, and then immediately said, I thought you were going to break 3 hours. What happened? I said, I don't know. I feel terrible. I think somebody hit me with a brick.
Dennis pointed to the goose egg on the top of his head. Linda told Dennis to get it checked out by the race doctor, but Dennis was in no rush to get medical attention. He'd failed to qualify for Boston. He was disappointed and hungry. Dennis grabbed a hot dog from the post-race food tent. Then, he started thinking about trying to qualify for Boston again. Eventually, he made his way to the race doctor.
Physician looked at the skull and peeled back the hair and the scalp and probed around. And finally said, I see something stuck down in your skull, and it's kind of has kind of a shine to it, like a metallic object. I think you've been shot. You better go to the hospital and have the emergency room take a look at this.
Dennis didn't believe the race doctor, but
the thought of a bullet in my head just about brought up the hot dog.
Dennis went to Butterworth Hospital in Grand Rapids with his wife. He still figured he'd been hit by a rock or a brick. Turns out, the race doctor was right. Hospital x-rays confirmed that there was a bullet lodged in Dennis's skull.
I had visions of, you know, a huge army projectile kind of thing embedded in my brain matter as your mind races away with that first kind of news. But I was still just irritated that we hadn't broken 3 hours.
The bullet was a .22 caliber, and it was lodged in the thickest part of his skull, almost flattened against the top of his head, which seems lucky.
Well, I was either incredibly lucky or incredibly unlucky. I guess it's a flip of the coin, isn't it? In the wrong place at the wrong time, but I was certainly lucky they didn't do more damage or hit me in a soft spot, or that it didn't penetrate a little bit further.
The doctor needed to remove the bullet without damaging it, because it was now police evidence.
So he's trying to pull a slug that's embedded in the skull out with plastic-tipped forceps, and now he's got betadine, and it's pretty wet, and he couldn't get a good grip. And he finally got enough of a bite on the bullet and was able to dislodge it and pull it out of the skull.
It took 3 stitches to sew up the entrance wound. The police came and took the bullet and asked Dennis if he had any idea how he got shot. He didn't, and told them,
I know one thing for sure. The bullet was there when I finished the race, and it was not there when I started the race. So they said, okay, thank you, and released me.
He put on some dry clothes, left the hospital, and went to a nearby restaurant.
Well, I was a little late for our dinner with my fellow runners. They were all waiting at the restaurant for me, and they said, what happened? I explained it.
Dennis told his fellow runners about the bullet, and
we had a good laugh about it, and said, and basically shrugged it off as just something that happened, didn't pay much attention to it.
And Dennis was back running the next day. But a few days after the Grand Valley Marathon, he got a mysterious phone call. The man on the other end asked Dennis what he looked like. Dennis asked why the man wanted to know. And the man told Dennis,
well, I was in that race, and I would have been running about your pace. And I have some people that are unhappy with me and out to get me. I just wonder if you bought one intended for me. Now, that was about the scariest thing of this whole thing. Could it possibly have been a deliberate attempt aimed at someone else?
Dennis wanted some answers, so he asked for the police report. The police had examined the mark scratched into the bullet's surface, the way the bullet impacted Dennis's skull, and the way it flattened out on one side, and they determined that
the bullet seemed to have been fired from a poorly maintained gun, a damaged gun, a gun that had been perhaps equipped with a silencer, It did not ricochet off of anything. It just plopped into the head.
The police never figured out where the bullet was fired from, but the marathon passed through an area where it wasn't unusual to find hunters. And Dennis thought he was probably hit by a hunter's errant shot, though he'll never know for sure. News reports about the marathoner shot in the head quickly spread from Michigan across the country. And Dennis couldn't believe all the attention he got, from TV talk shows to radio stations to newspapers. He even appeared on the game show To Tell the Truth. Back in Boston, reporters approached some marathon officials and told them what had happened. The officials figured, without being shot in the head, Dennis would have easily broken 3 hours and qualified. They offered him a spot in the 1979 Boston Marathon. At the Hopkinton start, Dennis lined up wearing a singlet with the words Bullet Man across the front.
Nobody else had earned it, so I took it. I picked up the moniker Bullet Man for a little while, and I wore that to several races. Yeah, it was a bit of a joke on myself, I guess, but I try to take my training and running seriously, but not take myself too seriously.
Over the next 4 decades, he ran 21 marathons and 6 ultramarathons, and a DNF, or did not finish, was never an option.
Believe me, it's really hard to justify a DNF when you've finished with a bullet in your head. So after that race, I don't think I ever failed to finish because it was, what would I say? I got tired? What would I say? I got sore?
Being the Bullet Man pushed Dennis to train harder and run faster. His personal best in the marathon is 2 hours, 37 minutes.
Would I have gotten there without the bullet? It's quite likely I would not have.
Let me get this straight. Getting shot in the head made you a better marathoner.
Yes. Yes.
Post-bullet, Dennis became a patent lawyer and moved to Virginia. Almost 40 years later, he's retired and splits his time between training for his next big race and visiting his 5 grandchildren. As for the bullet, well...
Actually, it's in a little Ziploc bag, and it has taken several trips to school as show and tell for the kids.
Dennis is still surprised by the attention that followed the Grand Valley Marathon, but he admits...
It's not the kind of thing you read about all that often, is it?
Yeah, I'd be hard-pressed to find another marathoner shot in the head who finishes a marathon.
Yeah, well, it was only 16 miles with the bullet, so it wasn't the whole way.
That's typical Dennis. Now, sometimes he'll deny he's the Bullet Man. Or he'll try.
I think it'll be on my tombstone.
That story was reported and produced by Only a Game's Shira Springer. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our intern is Dave Sousa. And our senior producer is Karen Given. Our final word this week comes from Dennis Rainier, who says Bullet Man is not his only nickname.
I've been called a lot of things. Most of them can't be repeated. Bullet Man is probably the better one.
Oh, all right, though I was hoping for something alliterative. Ricocheted runner, maybe. I don't know. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.